Hello, it's John Dennis with Guardian Daily on Thursday, December the 4th. Today, the stage is set for more drama in the Commons as the Home Secretary makes a statement on the arrest of Damian Green. Yesterday, the Speaker told MPs that the police acted unlawfully.
I must make it clear to the House that I was not asked the question of whether consent should be given or whether a warrant should have been insisted on. I did not personally authorise the search.
Also today, we'll wade through the millions of letters and parcels that the Royal Mail can't deliver because they haven't been addressed properly.
Live animals?
Yes, we do.
What kind of live animals?
Well, we get like bugs and all sorts of things that people obviously buy to feed their pet snakes or lizards or whatever. So we get locusts and crickets and all sorts of weird and wonderful bugs come through the post.
And the winner of the Guardian First Book Award is Alex Ross for his exploration of 20th century classical music. The rest is noise.
It's a huge honour just in and of itself, and I think especially for an American author with really no reputation over here to be singled out in this way.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's hear from Sandy Waugh, who's got the news headlines and the papers.
Canada's government's in turmoil after opposition leaders refuse to back plans to help the economy. The opposition say not enough is being done to stimulate business. They'll make the Conservative Prime Minister face a vote of confidence in the hope of replacing him with a coalition. But the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, responded by saying on television last night that he will ask the Governor-General to suspend Parliament. Thailand's international airports reopened after anti-government protesters ended their blockade. The Prime Minister stepped down and the governing party has disbanded because of a court order. But the party has reformed by switching to another party. They'll elect a new leader today, which is likely to cause more protests. The country is now looking to the 81-year-old king to find a solution. He's due to make a speech to the nation on the eve of his birthday. Zimbabwe has asked for outside help to tackle the outbreak of cholera in the country, so says the World Health Organization. The UN says more than 500 people have died. The health minister's admitted he's now short of medicine, equipment and the money to pay staff. Many of them are said to be staying away from work. We'll hear more about the situation from our correspondent in Zimbabwe later in the programme. The US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has arrived in Pakistan from India. Pakistan's refused a request from India to hand over 20 alleged terrorists to help with the investigation into the Mumbai attack. Rice is urging Pakistan to cooperate fully with India. She says the civilian government has to mount a robust response to terrorism. British news and more. Job losses have been announced in the city. The Japanese bank Nomura, which took over the failed US bank Lehman Brothers, will cut 1,000 staff in both companies. The Bank of England is expected to make another rate cut today by at least 1%, down to 2% in lending rates. The European Central Bank will also announce new interest rates and is under pressure to cut rates to stimulate business. Football, the results in the Carling Cup quarterfinals. Tottenham won again, 2-1 against Watford. Manchester United's Carlos Tevez scored a blistering hat-trick, helping his club to knock out Blackburn 5-3. In the Mirror, they call him Carlos the Treble. The Sun says, I'm in Tevin, and the Mail says, Tevez blitz sinks Fergie old boy Ince, referring to troubled Blackburn manager Paul Ince. The Mirror also says that Sunderland's manager, another former Man U player, Roy Keane, is thinking of quitting. The paper says that he's been having a personal crisis of confidence, wondering if he can really do the job at the top level. On the front pages, a favourite story is the government promised to help people who have trouble paying their mortgages after losing jobs. The Times calls it an emergency rescue. The Mail says it's a mortgage safety net for middle classes. The Guardian says the Prime Minister had to step in. Brown acts to stop wave of repossessions. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Today, MPs would ordinarily be chewing over the contents of the Queen's speech, but the government's grand legislative plans have been upstaged by the extraordinary events of yesterday when, in one of the most electrifying parliamentary sessions for years, Speaker Michael Martin revealed that the police investigating the Tory frontbencher Damian Green had marched into his parliamentary office without a warrant. Not only that, neither the Speaker nor his staff had asked the police for one. MPs were astounded, and today the Home Secretary Jackie Smith will make a statement on the affair in the Commons. The pressure on the police is piling up, And there are still questions too for Mr. Martin, who yesterday tried to explain his role.
The sergeant at arms called me, told me the member's name, and said that a search might take place of his offices in the house. I was not told that the police did not have a warrant. Order. I have been told that the police did not explain, as they are required to do, that the sergeant was not obliged to consent, or that a warrant could have been insisted upon. Order. I regret that a consent form was then signed by the sergeant at arms without consulting the clerk of the house.
Our senior political correspondent Andrew Sparrow joins me in the pod. Andy, Michael Martin's statement was a moment of high drama.
We'd had a lot of anticipation because we knew the Speaker was going to make this statement. The Speaker's been under a lot of pressure since Damien Green's offices were raided last week. We knew he had some explaining to do. What MPs didn't expect was that he was going to concede. He didn't say it very explicitly. He was obviously pretty nervous about this, but he conceded that he and his officials had let the police into Parliament without even asking them if they had a warrant. And that is really quite extraordinary, because anyone who's seen just one cop show knows the first thing you do when the police turn up at the door, you say, "Can I see your warrant?" And it seems that the House of Parliament, a place where they take the rights of MPs particularly carefully, no one even bothered to ask the question.
Are Michael Martin's days as Speaker numbered?
Well, they've been numbered for a long time, in the sense that he's been in office for, I think, 7-8 years now. He's sort of well into his 60s. He's at the age when it would be quite reasonable to expect him to stand down. His wife apparently isn't keen for him to serve through another parliament. And as you know, he's had a pretty difficult press, more or less, ever since he took that job. It's going to be hard to see now how he's going to explain to himself or think that there's any grounds for wanting to stay on past the next election. I expect at some point on a sort of busy news day or at a time when no one's going to pay very much notice, we'll get a diplomatic announcement that he's going to stand down as Speaker some point before the next election. It won't be directly because of this. He's a proud man. He's certainly not going to resign immediately, I don't think.
Now, a committee of MPs has been set up to examine the whole Damien Green saga. What questions will they want to ask the police in the light of Mr. Martin's extraordinary revelations yesterday?
Well, Michael Martin was in a sense trying to blame the police, because his line seemed to be, well, the police should have told us that we were entitled to ask them if they had a warrant. Frankly, I didn't find that a particularly convincing explanation. I mean, it's fairly obvious that the Sergeant-at-Arms, Jill Pay, just forgot to ask, and Michael Martin, who is being briefed and kept informed, he didn't bother to ask her, "Have you asked if they got a warrant?" So this committee is going to want to ask that, but that's not the real question. I think the real question is why were you bothering to arrest an MP in these circumstances over leaks which appear to have nothing to do with national security? And when the MP himself has said, "Well, if you ring me up, I'm quite happy to have a chat with you about it," why did you have to go about it in such a heavy-handed manner? And we've already had quite a lot of indications from the police that very, very senior officers at New Scotland Yard realised that was a mistake.
Mind you, he is still under investigation by the police. He denies any wrongdoing. This is what he told the Commons yesterday.
"Can I make it absolutely clear that I believe that members of Parliament are not above the law? An MP endangering national security would be a disgrace. An MP exposing embarrassing facts about Home Office policy, which ministers are hiding, is doing a job in the public interest."
Andy, the Home Secretary is making a statement to MPs today. What's Jackie Smith going to say?
Well, she's got some explaining to do as well, because she has changed her line over this. Initially, when she was approached, she said she didn't know that Damien Green was going to be arrested, and she'd kept very much at arm's length from the investigation because she felt it wasn't appropriate for her to get involved. And there's a long-standing and important convention in Britain that politicians don't get involved in operational matters. But then the Tories said to her, well, hang on, Boris Johnson was told about this, and he said to the police, well, it's not for me to tell you what to do, but frankly, old bean, if I were you, I'd think twice before you did this. So if the Mayor of London feels it's appropriate to at least express concerns about the sensitivity of arresting MPs, then why didn't Jackie Smith? And subsequently, she said earlier this week that she had spoken to the acting commissioner of the Met, not to tell him what to do, but just to be briefed about what was going on. She, I think, has got to clarify sort of whether it's her job to know and to be kept informed, or whether it's better that she is kept in the dark about these things. And we've had conflicting messages from the Home Office on this.
Well, this whole saga cast a shadow over yesterday's Queen's speech. Yesterday, Her Maj set out the government's agenda for the next Parliament, and not surprisingly, it focuses on tackling the recession. Andy, were any rabbits pulled out of hats in the Queen's speech?
We normally don't get rabbits pulled out of hats at the Queen's speech because the process of making legislation is a slow one. Often, government bills takes a year, 2 years, even 3 years in the making. The government publishes green papers, then white papers. Now they publish draft bills. So by the time we get to the Queen's speech, these are areas where anyone who's followed government policy in detail pretty much knows what they're planning to do. And Gordon Brown introduced this procedure where he started publishing a draft Queen's speech so that people could be consulted. So when the Queen stood up in the, or rather she didn't stand up, she sits on this spectacular golden throne and read the speech, there were no surprises at all. But we did get a rabbit in the afternoon because Gordon Brown had kept something back for the debate. He announced a deal that the government's done with lenders to help people who are in trouble paying their mortgages by giving them a 2-year deferment for some of their mortgage payments. That seems to be quite a significant announcement. He's desperate to avoid repossessions getting any higher than they are already, but it's slightly odd on a day when you've invited the Queen to tell you what the government's programme is for the Prime Minister to save the best bits for himself.
Andy Sparrow. And there's full coverage of Jackie Smith's statement to the Commons today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, diplomatic editor Julian Borger considers what Barack Obama can do about Guantanamo Bay and what the consequences of its closure are likely to be. Human rights lawyers, including Philippe Sands and Clive Stafford Smith, weigh up the options at guardian.co.uk/Guantanamo. An exclusive poem by the great Michael Rosen to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the NHS is at guardian.co.uk/books. And is it wrong to eat reindeer? Have your say on our food blog, guardian.co.uk/word of mouth. £1 million advertising campaign warning teenagers about the dangers of cocaine is launched today.
Turns out I've been used to smuggle cocaine into the country, which does rather prompt the question, what's the big deal with coke? So I talked to this dealer and he said,
it's all about the profit.
And making sure no one messes with us!
Okay, Mr. Gunn, sir.
And these headache pills he's cutting his coat with couldn't wait to tell me that
Actually, on the street it's only 30% cocaine.
And 70%, who the hell knows?
Then I met Mr. Disco here.
Lots of people doing it, Pablo!
Really? So I went to this nasty toilet and this girl asked me,
could you spare us a tenner?
No, I'm a dog.
According to the British Crime Survey, cocaine use has doubled in the last 10 years. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
The ad is voiced over by the comedian David Mitchell, and it features a slightly surreal storyline of a dog who wakes up dead, wakes up after dying, after being used as a drug mule between Colombia and Britain. And what he does is he traces back the route that's brought him to his demise. And so he interviews a dealer, a bag of cocaine, a heart, a nostril, and a banknote. And these interviews kind of highlight the nature of addiction, the heart attacks, personality changes, and the kind of fear and damage it can do to local communities through the cocaine trade.
Well, it's the first time we've ever really seen anything like this on the TV screens. Why is the government launching these ads?
Well, it's about a £1 million campaign, and it is a new departure for the government's advertising, health campaigning, drugs information. Frank, they call their campaign, which brings together people from the Home Office and from the Department of Health. And I think it's overall, we've seen the latest British crime survey figures came out last month, that overall illicit drug use is actually declining. And this campaign is aimed particularly at 15 to 18-year-olds. And I think the ads will feature quite strongly on Channel 4, as well as a range of internet sites, amongst whom cocaine use seems to be pretty stable at about 5% of the population. That equates to about 320,000 teenagers who are said to have used cocaine in the last year. So they're trying very specifically to target that group of cocaine users, amongst whom it seems to be a fairly well set habit now.
But to use an ad, I mean, is there any? Do we know how effective such a campaign might be likely to be?
I think it's unusual in the sense that we've had health campaign ads in the past, haven't we, which I think have proved effective. Previously, we know from American experience that ads which just say no to drugs have been shown to be less than effective, and a sort of abstentionist message hasn't really worked because it hasn't really chimed with the experience of young people and teenagers. It may be that this may be more effective than, say, I remember 2 or 3 years ago when Sir Ian Blair started his time as Metropolitan Police Commissioner, he threatened to start raiding middle-class dinner parties in order to crack down on cocaine use, and that sent a sort of terror for about a few seconds around the dinner tables of North and South London and the metropolitan media elite. But we don't actually ever seem to have any reports of police raids on dinner parties, so we assume that this might actually money be better spent.
Alan Travis. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, the Guardian First Book Award. Alex Ross shines a light into the dark corners of 20th century classical music. And in our weekly showbiz slot, Rachel Hilton from X Factor.
The little gun-toting thing, I would like to approach that subject and let people know if I caused any offence, I'm really sorry, but I don't own a gun. I never will own a gun.
But first, chaos in Zimbabwe, where 565 people have now died from a cholera epidemic, according to the UN. The outbreak's been blamed on the country's economic crisis. Meanwhile, the government is in paralysis, with President Robert Mugabe and opposition politicians unable to agree on how to share power. Anger is spilling out onto the streets. Riot police clashed with a street demonstration of doctors and nurses yesterday, and on Monday, soldiers went on the rampage over unpaid wages. In Harare for The Guardian is Chris McGreal.
Doctors and nurses marched on the health ministry to protest at the closure of many hospitals, some of the biggest hospitals in Harare, that are simply not functioning anymore. They wanted to deliver a petition to the health minister, but the police broke up the march fairly aggressively. They also broke up a march by trade union leaders and a few dozen trade unionists to the central bank to demand the lifting of restrictions on the amount of money people can take out of their bank accounts. The police rounded up trade union leaders and took them away. The government did announce, though, that it was lifting some restrictions on the amount of that you can take out of your bank account here. Until this point, it has been about 18 pence a day has been the maximum withdrawal limit. That's going to be raised to £33 a week, approximately, in Zimbabwe dollars. And it comes on the heels of soldiers rioting in the centre of Harare on Monday. There are great questions about whether the government actually has the cash notes to be able to distribute to the banks and meet the demand for these withdrawals. It is introducing that new $100 million note today. There remains a great cash shortage because of the hyperinflation. Many shops no longer accept Zimbabwe dollars for most of their goods. They will only take foreign currency.
Meanwhile, the cholera epidemic is spreading beyond the borders outside Zimbabwe. Is there anything more that Zimbabwe's neighbours can do and the wider international community to help the people?
Well, this is the usual tussle between aid and isolating repressive governments. Certainly a large injection of foreign aid and medical help would alleviate the situation, but there's a great reluctance by Western countries to do that because they believe that it would help prop up Mugabe's government, which is widely considered to be illegitimate. In the short term, there is medical aid coming in. I think the European Union is now offering money to help alleviate the cholera crisis, which, as you say, has spread to South Africa. It has said now that the Limpopo River between Zimbabwe and South Africa is infected with cholera, and the numbers of people being infected is rising by about 1,000 a day, at least.
Chris McGreal.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Each year, around 35 million parcels, letters and packages aren't addressed properly. They find their way to a warehouse the size of an aircraft hangar in central Belfast, otherwise known as the Returned Mail Centre. Henry MacDonald, our Ireland correspondent, visited the centre as staff prepared for a seasonal surge in misdirected post.
We have a car seat here for a baby. You have a Thomas the Tank Engine set. You have bicycle wheels, garden equipment, a nappy wrapper for cleaning nappies, one assumes. A Doctor Who item, Empress of the Arachnos. There you go, for all you Doctor Who fans. And a mini violin.
I'm Debbie McCauley. We're here in the National Returns Centre in Belfast. I'm one of the team managers here. We are responsible for returning all of the undeliverable mail for the whole of the United Kingdom.
How much mail are we talking about?
On average, we deal with 600,000 items a week. The year's total is around 35 million. We are continually amazed by how poorly addressed some of the items are that come through here. We will have completely blank envelopes with huge sums of money in them. The most common items that we get are cards that just have, you know, David or Granny or whatever on them. You wouldn't believe the things we see on a daily basis. We've become somewhat immune to it, but I think anybody looking from the outside in would be quite astounded by the variety of things that come through the post.
That's us into the really secure area, you could call it. And here we are. And now I'm speaking to
Tara Connor. We deal in this particular area with items of high intrinsic value, so it's special deliveries, international sign for items.
What sort of weird and wacky things do people send through the post but misaddress?
From the sublime to the ridiculous, we do get every item that you could imagine under the sun we receive in here, from live animals when they were put in the post.
Live animals?
Yes, we do.
What kind of live animals?
Well, we get like bugs and all sorts of things that people obviously buy to feed their pet snakes or lizards or whatever. So we get locusts and crickets and all sorts of weird and wonderful bugs come through the post.
And these are locusts and bugs and crickets that people have misaddressed?
Misaddressed, or they haven't been claimed, or they haven't been called for, or the address the unknowns. You know, there's so many different reasons that things aren't delivered, unfortunately. And we have to pick up the slack for that.
Just looking at over here at this Aladdin's Cave of the weird and the wacky, give me some. What stands out in your mind that people have sent, or rather missent through the post?
I personally like everything. It really is a treasure trove. We get helmets, Star Wars helmets, replica World Cups, old-fashioned gas masks, toys, teddies. I mean, you really could put your hand on any spectrum of item in here. Musical instruments, we do get an awful lot of stuff through DVDs, CDs. We got pints of milk sent through the post, 2 litres cartons of milk sent through the post, which we think's very strange indeed, because unfortunately by the time it gets to us, you know, it unfortunately, if there's no return address either internally or externally, it has to be disposed. That's the unfortunate thing.
Undeliverable mail, that by definition is anything that has an incomplete address, where someone has gone away, where the person it's been sent to is deceased. There's various reasons for non-delivery. Once they come to us, only if they have no return address on the outside, we are the only office in Royal Mail that is permitted to open mail, and we can then go through the item to try and find an address that we can return that item to sender by. Unfortunately, some of those items aren't claimed, and in those cases, the money from those items are banked, and that helps to pay for the service, which is covered entirely by the business.
Henry MacDonald reporting. Alex Ross was named last night as the winner of the 2008 Guardian First Book Award for his exploration of modern classical music, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. Ross, the music critic for the New Yorker magazine, set out with the help of a blog to discover how classical composers interacted with the often horrifying events of the 20th century. The award was presented to Ross last night at a ceremony in London.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the Guardian First Book Award. Well, the shortlist of books was stronger than ever this year, and in making the decision, the judges were looking for promise and for originality and also for achievement. Did a book actually do what it set out to do? So let's take a look at those five shortlisted books.
Ross isn't obtrusive in the narrative. He doesn't kind of, you know, foist himself, direct himself at you. He's kind of well composed, well structured.
The central character, the narrator of God's Own Country, is a young lad, Sam Marsdale, who lives with his parents in this very remote farm on the moors, and it's a pretty grim place.
The shocking reality of it, the hardship that these people had to endure. I kept thinking of them as fictional people and had to remind myself that they were real, they were real letters.
You won't be able to hear any 20th century music from Strauss through to Radiohead and Bjork in the same way. So I'm really, really pleased to welcome Alex Ross and to announce that the winner of this year's award is the West.
Well, I feel absolutely great. I mean, it's a huge honor just in and of itself, and I think especially for an American author with really no reputation over here to be singled out in this way amid some wonderful other authors is just extraordinary for me. So I'm just sort of, you know, floating about here. My plan from the beginning was to try to bring music into the thick of the general conversation about what happened to the arts in the 20th century and really, you know, the history of the century itself, because you find the composers in the middle of some of the most dramatic circumstances of the century, whether it's Shostakovich during the siege of Leningrad or Aaron Copland being called before Senator McCarthy's committee. You know, from beginning to end, composers are in the middle of the mayhem of the century itself. And I think it was a story that has been told, but I did want to do it in the most accessible way, though without simplifying the story, while staying true to its full complexity. But I certainly wanted to reach a wider readership. I mean, not so much for my own benefit, but because I just find it painful that that composers are left out of these the sort of general sense that we have of how artists in general sort of created modernism in the 20th century and you know where they went on from there. I mean, you find Picasso and Jackson Pollock and James Joyce and T.S. Eliot. These artists are so much more well known than Schoenberg, Stravinsky, Britten, and Shostakovich. So that was the sort of parody that I was seeking.
And there's full coverage of the Guardian First Book Award, including an excerpt from Alex Ross's book, at guardian.co.uk/books. Now, question time with Hannah Poole, the audio version of Hannah's weekly Q&A in the Guardian G2 features section. This week, Hannah spoke to Rachel Hilton from X Factor.
What did you think of the makeover that they gave you?
I liked the very first one I had. You know, when we done the VTs, the VT shots, the video transmission shots where you see before with the Rachel Hilton, that them shots. I loved my hair then, and I was a bit slimmer then, and I think I started to get a bit lazy over that period, and I just started to eat a lot, so I put on weight. But that was part of a problem I had on the X Factor too, because I didn't feel confident at times. All the other girls were slim, and I was just swelling up, and when I'd started in boot camp I was smaller and stuff.
Do you think they knew what to do with you?
I don't know, because of the type of personality that I am, I've taken on board that sometimes people just don't get me. So I think maybe there was a possibility they just didn't get me.
Do you think some of that was a class thing?
I don't think it was a class thing. I just think people just didn't get me. Even some people in the public didn't get me. And because they didn't get me, they found it easier to judge me on my past rather than my performance.
Do you think it was a race thing?
I'm not going to say that. Because okay. I don't really want to get into that. Because that is, to me, to start getting into the race thing and the this thing is a bit... It's touching kind of shaky ground, and I don't really want to go there. But the little gun toting thing, I would like to approach that subject and let people know if I caused any offence, I'm really sorry, but I don't own a gun, I never will own a gun. And just like when you go to a rock concert and they put up the devil horns, rock out, you don't see Christians going storming, the things going, no, Christians, stop doing devil horns. So it's the same thing when we go, brah, 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 that's a celebratory thing we do, just like when you go rock out or hoo, hoo, hoo. It's a celebratory thing. I didn't mean to cause any offence.
Rachel Hilton. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.